Comic and talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemon. This episode is produced in partnership with West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
This is the Best of the West, inspiring women with real stories, hosted by West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
Hello and welcome to Best of the West. I'm your host, Danielle, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Judy Myers, who is currently Professor Emerita at the Department of Zoology at the University of British Columbia. She joined the faculty in 1972, and her research takes an interdisciplinary, collaborative, inclusive approach to the management of environmental pest problems. Judy has served on various Natural Sciences and Research Council of Canada, or NSERC, committees, particularly those that relate to women in science, including the Women's Faculty Award Committee, the Women in Science and Engineering Chair Program. She was a member of the NSERC Biological Control Networks as a theme leader of greenhouses from 2001 to 2006 and co-theme leader of new improved microbial agents for management of insect pests from 2001 to 2006. Judy was at the forefront of Canadian post-secondary education's efforts to recruit more women in STEM fields during the late 1980s and early 1990s when she was a Associate Dean of Science at University of British Columbia. She continues to be a strong advocate for women in STEM. In addition to her 2014 to 2016 presidency of the Canadian Society for Ecology and Evolution, or CSEE, Judy is past president of Canadian Coalition for Women in Science, Engineering, Trades, and Technology, also known as CC West, and part of the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology, SCWST. Whew! After all that, welcome, Judy, to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a bit about what is occupying your days currently.
Well, I should start by saying that I retired in 2006. I was the last year that had to retire in British Columbia, so I've had a number of years in retirement, which has been great. What occupies me mostly is trying to write up some past research that we've done. And also, I had a grandson in September, so that is occupying me a lot right now.
So how did you end up, it feels silly to ask about one specific thing, but what drew you to the area of research that you ended up working in?
I think, I'm an ecologist. I'm a population ecologist, and I was always interested in the outdoors, and therefore that was seemed to be the path through ecology. And when I started, I got my PhD in 1970, really it was a rather young field. I mean, people had been doing ecology for years and years and years, but it was just at that time the textbooks were coming out, it was beginning to blossom, and I thought, this is great for me. But I also had this feeling of wanting to do something that was applied. I wanted to be able to say more than I'm just really interested in this basic question. I wanted to see how basic ecology related to serious problems, particularly in agriculture. And I was joint appointed between zoology and the Faculty of Agriculture, now Faculty of Land and Food Systems at UBC. So biological control seemed like a really good path to go, because it's based on basic plant and insect ecology, and yet the goal is to try to reduce pests in a way using the natural enemies, particularly in situations where you have invaded areas like rangeland areas in which a weed has been brought in from some other country, and so you try to reestablish the control with natural enemies.
That's amazing. So way back in the day, was there anything that really pushed you into studying something within science and pursuing a STEM field specifically?
That's the really hard one to answer, because one sort of follows your passion to some degree. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there were twists and turns. I started out, quite frankly, babysitting for the son of some biologists who worked on butterflies. And I found this fascinating. And they were going to Trinidad and they said, do you want to come along and babysit? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And then when I got to Trinidad, I found I was much more interested in the research. And I look back on this now and think I hardly did any babysitting. Got this great interest in butterfly courtship. And I went on to do that for a master's degree. But that's when I had this feeling like butterfly courtship. Yeah, it's interesting, but maybe it's very relevant. So during my master's degree, I had a rather famous professor from Cornell University tell me that I should not pursue the project I was doing for a PhD because he wanted his student to do that. And he said, we all know that women just don't ever use their degrees. They get married, they have kids, they drop out. And so that was a red flag for me.
Yeah, I'd say so. And,
the story goes that I had dinner once with the wife of my ecology professor. This was at Tufts University. And she said, oh, you should go and work for this chap, Charlie Krebs, who is well known in ecology now, and because he's a nice man. And I thought, you know, that was the advice I needed. And So I went off to Indiana University and worked on small mammals first before I got into the insect and plant world. So yes, things happen and you look back on them and you think, could have gone other directions.
Yeah, but often, and in my personal involvement with SQIST in the past, I find that those networks of women and the recommendations of other women to say, this is a good place to go, this is a good person to work for, it means a lot, especially in male-dominated industries.
Well, it was interesting because the reason that she invited me for dinner, because her husband, who was an ecologist, was in the field in Alaska, and she had a small child, and she was feeling rather lonesome and stuff. So, yeah, you make those connections just fortuitously.
Yeah. So can you share with me some of your most memorable moments from throughout your career?
Well, I was involved in the first Earth Day when I was doing my PhD, and I still remember that as being a really exciting time and a lot of enthusiasm. So that would have been in 1969-ish, I think. Of course, it's always memorable when you get a job because you can go from, I have no idea what I'm going to be doing in the next 6 months to all of a sudden seeing a way forward. Mm-hmm. So that was memorable. I met my husband at UBC because he was hired the year after I was. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a relationship made in heaven or something. I don't know. And then I had two kids and that was certainly memorable.
Of course.
And just a lot of nice things happen.
That's amazing. That's always a good thing to be able to say about your career.
It is, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you find it being an academic woman in a STEM field and taking breaks to have kids and things like that? How did you navigate that? And were you supported?
I was the first woman in the Faculty of Science at UBC to take maternity leave. And I walked into the dean and said, I want to take maternity leave. And he said, fine, just tell me what to do. Because that day there was no policy. There was no, which was essentially, I just said, well, I'm not going to be teaching this term and because I'm having this baby. And then I will go back to teaching in the autumn. So I had 4 months maternity leave for my son, and I was on sabbatical when my daughter was born, so nobody knows what you're doing. So that worked out well. But I think my colleagues were very supportive. And of course, it also helped to have one's husband in the same department. And it turned out that my PhD advisor was in the same department. So both of those and then the other ecology colleagues I thought were very supportive in ways that maybe they're not so supportive in other departments, but worked for me.
That's good to hear. Yeah. That's good to know. So previously on the podcast, we've been very honored to have Dr. Maria Clave join us before and share a bit about of her wonderful wisdom. And I know you were involved in the chair program, the NSERC Chairs for Women in Science Engineering program very early on. Did you feel that there was a lot of, I guess, resistance to it at the time? Or did you feel it was a pretty successful implementation early on?
Well, it started with one woman who was an engineer and a real fighter, Monique Fries. Mm-hmm. And then as her term came to an end, there was a review of the program, and it was decided to expand to different parts of the country so that there was more than one involved in.
Yeah, one woman versus the country. A little daunting.
And I find it hard to believe. I think that program was accepted because I don't think that it in some ways was as threatening. I think it was the Women's Faculty Award program in which there was a program specifically to put women in academic positions. And so this is very easily seen as direct competition mm-hmm. with young males and a feeling that that wasn't fair. And I have to say that, back to Maria, that during her reign as Dean of Science, the proportion of women went up markedly through the use of that program, which gave her an extra, let's say, stick to to move forward on that. And then, you know, as soon as she left, things slipped back a bit again. But and I haven't been keeping track. But in biology or in zoology, in the ecology evolution areas anyway, there have been quite a few women hired. And the other thing is that they have tended to stay. So young males have tended to leave after several years. As you well know, it's very expensive to live in Vancouver. It's difficult for them, their wives, to get positions here. And so there's been a lot of turnover amongst the males. The women have come, and I think partly because of the good maternity leave program mm-hmm. that we have, and it's particularly good in the Faculty of Science, and very supportive. And my feeling is, and I don't really know, but that women have come here, had babies, and have stayed because of that program to some degree. Yeah,
having that kind of support and not feeling like you're punished for taking that time to build a family is...
Yep.
I can imagine that would create a little bit of loyalty. So, Judy, was there anyone in your life who helped kind of champion you or support you through your education and your career?
Well, first of all, I should say my parents were always very supportive. And so that always helps. Particularly was very proud. And they were happy with anything I did. And as I went on in my career, I think that my PhD advisor was supportive. And then because we ended up at the same university and the same system, there was more opportunity for him to be supportive. Of course, my husband, as I mentioned, who is also a zoologist, was very supportive and certainly helped in the whole balance of raising kids. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I look back to when I was raising kids, and I feel that life was so much easier than it is for young people now. And I blame that all on email and electronic stuff. Even preparing lectures now, you have so many resources available to make the perfect PowerPoint slide or whatever that you feel you should. But in the day... you made an overhead, or in the day before that, you'd put it on the board, and it was a lot easier anyway. So I don't know that education's gotten any better with all this stuff, but it does seem to take much more time.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense. Do you think it's really key for women to have supportive partners or really supportive people in their lives to keep them in STEM?
Oh, I do. I mean, I think one hears stories of people who have supportive partners, and it can have a very serious consequence. I know of some women who have certainly still succeeded. It's not necessarily the final blow, but yes, having somebody to share things with. I was particularly lucky because my spouse was also a biologist, so we used to have great discussions over dinner or whatever. So, but maybe that's not the best. I think you can also have spouses who do something totally different. And but I always advise, always marry somebody who is smarter than you are, if that's a choice. Now, you know, I think there are many different paths and to success. I do think that the research shows often that single people have a much more battle to maintain some sort of a social system, which again takes up more time than people who are happily partnered, because you've got your support system there. Mm-hmm. People who are unhappily partnered, well, that makes it much more difficult.
Definitely. So, Judy, given your background working with CC West and SCWST, obviously big advocate for women in STEM, where do you see us now? What do you see us trying to move forward on now that we've put so many years of work into advocating for women's further participation in STEM?
Well, I think we can't stop. And one of the other groups that I've been slightly involved with is that each year at the Canadian Society for Ecology and Evolution, there is a meeting, workshop, symposium on women entering ecology and evolution. Mm-hmm. And SWEET, it's called. And I was involved in that just last summer again. And you hear stories that are just the same as they were when I started with SCWST or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I don't think it'll ever be over, because I think that there are in humans these really ingrained biases that are hard to recognize. And you, I'm sure, have seen all the things that have come out, show people the same CV with a woman's name on it or a man's mm-hmm. name on it, that type of thing. It just seems to be hardwired, and I don't think, other than if we go into some sort of drug culture where we age people, that I don't know. I'll tell you a little story about my daughter. Is a lecturer at University of Edinburgh mm-hmm. in biology and plant ecology, and there was a meeting having to do with teaching allocations. And after this meeting, a young male faculty had just been hired, sent an email, and by mistake circulated it to everybody that was at the meeting instead of the head of school, recommending that my daughter and another woman should take over his teaching because he had this important research to do and he was much too busy to do the teaching. And I think it's great that that email was circulated to everybody, but you just say, well, there it is. Well, it'd take two women to do his teaching, but yeah, the women should be doing this. I shouldn't be, because I am too important and I have too much research to do.
Yeah.
So it goes on, and you just have to be at it all the time and yet not get discouraged by it. Not you have to laugh. I mean, if I were her, I just would have sent around a little smiley medium and been done with it. But it happens.
It does. It does. And I think you're right about not stopping. Because even when you mentioned, you know, when Maria Clave's chair and her deanship moved, it's, you know, things slip back. Mm-hmm. People slip back into those older patterns when they're not reminded, hey, diversity and inclusion is a big deal all the time, not just when someone's looking. So I think that's some of the really important work we try to keep up here as well. So given all your years of experience in academia, what advice do you have for grad students who are currently trying to figure out kind of whether to go in academia or what they're going to do with their careers and the next step? What would you say to them?
Well, I guess I base it on my own experience, in which it seemed to me that things just happened. I don't know that I made a bunch of decisions. It just seemed that life unrolled, and I went with it. I think now that there are so many more PhDs coming out and things like that, that it's important to think about these other careers, that, that academic life is not the only career path. Particularly, I think now that there is so much opportunity in NGOs working in conservation and things like that, you see that many women are really having, I think, very fulfilled lives by doing things outside of academia. The other thing is that I feel that the academic life really is very hard. And again, I speak to this from my daughter, who has a position now as a lecturer, and it's so much pressure to do the teaching, to do the research, which is what drives many of us, finding that time for research, and yet trying to maintain some sort of a lifestyle, that life balance or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's very, very difficult, I think, particularly for women. How you deal with that, and of course, a lot of people are finding partners through the internet now and things like that. In fact, I think everybody that I know who's recently gotten married, you know, has found a partner that way. So maybe the internet's not totally bad, but I think mostly just keeping your options open. The other thing is that, and I've seen time after time, it's this thing about confidence, and particularly in things like exams, qualifying exams, for example. I just wish that there was a confidence pill that one could give to young women, to make them shine, because they've got the ability, and yet some are their own worst enemies because of that.
Yeah.
And that just comes partly from having a supportive environment, but I think it's a real battle for some women.
Yeah, I think I've had some good discussions about this with various women about how we socialize young children. We often, in elementary school, girls perform really well, and boys can be a bit more of a handful. And so often the boys are praised for trying, because they sat there and they tried and they, you know, stayed at their desk, and that's what we're praising. But for girls, you praise them when they get the answer right. And so this translates into the, you know, good job for trying, good job for being perfect, kind of dichotomy that can kind of hang people up. Like, oh, am I being perfect? Am I doing this really well?
But I think one of the big changes that has happened in this whole area over time is that when I first started as associate dean, it was still that the women were coming to UBC in science and dropping out at a higher rate. Maybe they weren't. There weren't so many being accepted at UBC, and now they are the majority, I think, in terms of undergraduates. And I hear these stories about in high schools and things like that. Some of the girls have told me, oh, the boys just want to play hockey. So, no, they don't care one way or the other. And I think there has been this pivot point that has occurred, which is just as worrisome, because why can't everybody fulfill their potential? And well, maybe their patrol is playing hockey, but I don't think that's going to work for many of the guys. So you got to be careful that you don't flip too much the other direction. And why can't it just be everybody fulfilling their potential and dreams?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm going to circle back to something you said about work-life balance. Over the years, what have you learned about work-life balance? And do you think there's a good balance to be achieved? Do you think it's something that you work at for pretty much all of your life?
Probably you work at it for all of your life. But, my first recommendation for young women, say if you've got an academic job, is to go and find yourself a house cleaner. Yes. Your time is not worth wasting on cleaning your house. So I think, finding things like that that make life simpler for you. Some might say, oh, well, you just give up on all the worrying about tidiness and things like that. I was never able to do that because if it got too out of control, then I was too distracted by things.
Right.
So for some people, that probably works. You just say, I'm not going to bother with the messiness or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And guys are better at that. You know, I used to get up in the morning and I have to have everything all worked out before I could sit down and start to work. Whereas my husband would get up and all that stuff didn't matter. And he would just be able to focus. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I find the same thing, that if it gets too messy, I get a little bit too distracted. And I think these days, I mean, you can have your groceries delivered, you can have someone plan out the meals for your family and deliver all the ingredients pre-portioned. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many services these days that if something is taking too much of your time or stressing you out that you don't love doing, like, I personally love to cook, but some people don't. And I think there's a lot of really wise choices you can make to make your life a little bit less full that way.
Mm. But that takes organization too.
It does.
So that, you have to say, oh, am I going to start writing on this paper this morning, or am I going to organize my food delivery for the next week?
You know, yeah.
Sometimes it's easier just to get a takeout.
Yes. Yeah. But I think it's wise to find those corners we can cut and not feel guilty that we're not doing 110% of everything.
I agree.
So you mentioned earlier that you're currently writing up some research that you've done in the past. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your research and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, I'm a population ecologist. So that means that I'm interested in what makes the densities of plants and animals go up and down over time. Now, in some of those cases, the organism might be a pest. And so what we want to achieve is making it go down, particularly mm-hmm. in crops and things like that. Sometimes they're just parts of the ecosystem and they go up and down. And so part of this, because of my interest in populations, which I think are the cornerstone of so much of the world.
Yeah,
you know, whether species are going extinct and how that affects the biodiversity, all down to population. But my other sort of passion, not that I've done very much about it, is that the human population, I think, is one of the most serious problems we're faced with.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really is willing to take that on. Nobody has sat down and said, look at Canada. It's in this northern area. All the population is right on the 49th parallel practically. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy to think that the population of humans can just keep going up and up and up without dire consequences, which is going to happen because humans only respond to dire consequences.
You know, yeah.
It's only when there's death and starvation of you or your family that people begin saying, oh, maybe we should have done something. And whether or not it will be possible to, once that really is hit. I mean, certainly there are areas of the world now that things are incredibly dire, mostly because of the human population density. Not enough food. There are, everything is warming up and that's having major changes.
Mm-hmm.
But also there are these periodic changes in rainfall and things like that. And that has these real serious consequences for a number of years. And then things get better and everybody says, oh, well, you know, it's better again. And then, of course, you get wars, which is associated with overcrowding as well. So that, to me, is sort of like a passion. I had an email from my nephew the other day, and he said, why is it that you're so much against doing research in space travel? And my strong feeling on that is, you know, until we get this planet sorted out, we should not be spending the zillions of dollars on things related to space or sending Teslas into outer space or wherever, you know. I mean, that's just male ego stuff.
I can't say I disagree with that one. Yeah, it's really interesting the perspective that some people take on our planet and the perspective of leaving it and not having to deal with the current problems that we're facing. But we all know that not everyone can get on the spaceship and leave, so we should probably, you know, take care of the planet.
And who would want to? Who would want? I mean, there are people signing up to go one-way trips to Mars. Sure wouldn't be me.
So other than not reading too much into human population research, what else do you get up to in your spare time?
Well, I have a